This is the Vajra regent, Ursul Tenzin, at a seminar entitled The Bodhicharya Vitara, held at Naropa Institute in Boulder, Colorado. This is talk number 2, June 16th, 1980. This is an ARP digital remaster made January 2008.
This will be the Vajra regent, Ursul Tenzin, Naropa Institute, June 16th, 1980, a class on the Bodhicharya Vitara. This is talk 2 of the class.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. It's very good to be teaching again at Naropa Institute. Over the past 6 years, it's been extremely inspiring to present the Buddhist teachings both to people who have practiced before and those who haven't. I suppose the main point is that one's mind could be fresh all the time. And the difference between a student has practiced and one who hasn't in the moment is no difference. Because in the moment, mind is fresh and awake. Talking about awake is the nature of our course and the course of study. This session, based on the Bodhicharya Avatara of Shantideva, the whole notion of this teaching of the Mahayana is basically to talk about how we wake up, and when we wake up, what happens to us, what we should do, what we shouldn't do, how we should proceed, and what result that has. So the path of awakening, the Mahayana path. Mahayana means a greater vehicle. Vajracharya talked about the Hinayana last time, and I think it's necessary for us to go over that, especially for new practitioners, that the development of karuna, or compassion, must have as its basis the one-pointed development, one-pointed concentration that is only possible through meditation practice. And this is a very definite point, because otherwise we could find ourselves in a situation where we would think that developing compassion means that we have to do all kinds of silly things. We could read a lot of books where we find that bodhisattvas have given their body, flesh and bones, to sentient beings, and misinterpret that to mean that we, as human beings, should do, in all cases, whatever comes to mind that we think is beneficial to others. But there is actual path and understanding of what is beneficial to others, which is not based on any kind of wishful thinking or delusion. It's based on the firm foundation of understanding the nature of our own mind and body and our environment altogether. Without that, it's impossible to develop real compassion. So, to begin with, in entering the Mahayana path, we must have the experience of what's called Maitri, M-A-I-T-R-I, which is a Sanskrit word meaning kindness our loving kindness. And that sense of Maitri begins with ourselves. We have to take care of this first. Because basically, this, meaning me, you, ourselves, is where we have a question. Usually we have no idea what's good for ourselves, what's bad for ourselves. We simply follow a fashion. What's fashionable? If it's fashionable in our age to wear certain clothing or eat certain food, speak in a certain way, read certain books, have allegiance to particular philosophers or politicians, well, we do it because we are swept up in the tide of what's fashionable, current. And we think at that point that we're being good to ourselves. By being current, up to date. To really be good to oneself means that we acknowledge in the moment who we are and what we are. Without the cloud of memory and preconception and habitual thinking. So how to be good to oneself? How to develop that kind of kindness to oneself? Vajracharya talked about klesha activity last time, if you remember. The ignorance which produces jealousy and hatred, aggression, pride, lust, stupidity. The emotions which propel us to create harm to ourselves and others. How to overcome that neurotic activity of these kleshas? It is extremely important, in fact, fundamentally important, that we understand how it is that such activity is generated. When it is generated, what is the tone and the texture of that activity? And when it subsides, what is the result? This means we must understand how our mind functions altogether. And the only way to accomplish that, that's been tried and tested since the time of the Buddha, is the sitting practice of meditation. Why so? Because the actual practice itself has no allegiance to pleasure or pain. The actual practice itself is not aligned. It doesn't have allegiance to who we are when we're angry, or who we are when we're happy, who we are when we're jealous or prideful. It is simply a practice that starts with no assumption, a bare field. And from that bare field, the actual awareness, which is necessary to see klesha activity, develops. So this meditation practice, this simple sense of being with the breath and the body posture, which you heard about last time, is the only practice which does not have a past and a future. So you sit with yourself, by yourself, and you begin to see how things arise. You begin to see when such things arise as emotions, strong emotions, thought patterns and bodily sensations, you begin to see how your mind becomes disturbed, affected by such an occurrence. You also begin to see that when that occurrence subsides, what happens to you, the practitioner? With that experience, when one is practiced, we begin to understand the nature of this, what we call me. And we begin to see that things constantly are in upheaval. Due to ignorance on our own part of how things work and what things are, we attach ourselves to particular emotions and thought patterns and sensations, and we call that me. From that, it expands tremendously to the point of a history. We start to develop a history of me. And that history becomes ingrained so that when we have a certain experience of a particular kind of emotion, we have a certain me that go along with it. So, in practicing meditation, we begin to see that that me we call ourselves is simply the product of whatever arises in our mind. So we call me the angry me and the happy me or whatever. That's called ego. Ego is the ultimate misnomer. Taking oneself to be whatever arises in one's mind. From that point of view, we begin to see that this notion of self altogether is questionable. So the experience of a practitioner along the path, after having dedicated themselves to the basic practice, is that this thing called self, me, actually is empty. Shunya is the word in Sanskrit. It has no definite reality at all. But it's simply like shades of color which are produced by temperature and light. So we begin to see that this me is actually non-existent. Two things happen. When we experience that, there's a sense of relief, ultimately. Relief, to begin with. Just kind of a sigh. We've been working so hard on this me for so long. At the same time, there's a panic. What about this perception of things? Aside from me, there's you and this and that and seemingly all this stuff. How does that relate to no me? At this point, I could be a fire hydrant. There is a definite sense of panic at that point. Well, there might be a fire, right? What would you do? Somebody has to put the hose in. There's no me. Who's going to do it? Further practice. At that point, the panic understood also as empty. Because it doesn't stay around. It changes. You have an experience of egolessness, sudden sense of healthiness without description. And then, immediately on the heels of that, panic. So then you look around saying, what's that, what's that, what's that? So if you further your practice of shamatha, one-pointedness, development of a peacefulness, settling one's mind, you begin to look at other, that which you perceive, not from the point of view of what does it mean to me, but just for what it is. When you look at things for what they are, you begin to see exactly the same thing as what you saw in yourself. That there is no solid sense of a this is always this. We begin to see that this world of ours changes all the time. Things are born, they grow, and they die. With that perception, you begin to see the emptiness of other. So, other has no ego either. This experience comes about through the practice of sitting meditation and is absolutely essential in order to develop compassion. Do you understand why? If we did not have that experience of reality, then our compassion would be based on some motive of gain, some sense of preservation. If we take one little pocket to be the real one, still we haven't penetrated to the truth, the reality. We might say, well, basically I'm not concerned about myself anymore because I realize that this self is a changing thing. It's simply a matter of like the weather. It'll be sunny one day and cold the next. Some days it'll rain and some days snow. But at the same time, you might say, but that's real. That little stone over there with my grandfather's grave, that's real over there. You might not say it to yourself as a conviction, some kind of conviction, but somehow you're thinking, I have something to hold on to, that tombstone, or this keepsake that my parents gave me, came from the Mayflower. When we have that experience, then we cannot check it out with anybody as such. Then we have conviction, because we don't need to check it out yet. Some sort of conviction develops about the nature of reality, that it is in nature shunya, empty. And therefore there is no obstruction. In the Bodhicharya Avatara, Shantideva says that such a thing occurs so rarely that once it has occurred, if we don't make use of it now, then we have wasted what might be our only opportunity. The description of awakening to the nature of reality, to reality itself in the Bodhicharya Avataras, is likened to a flash of lightning in a dark sky. That momentary flash of lightning illuminates what is. Suddenly in darkness you can actually see. And that opportunity and that experience is so rare that the Buddha said it was like a tortoise in the middle of the ocean, stormy ocean, right? Trying to put its head through a, what? Ring, right? Some kind of ring. Trying to put its head through in the middle of that. In a dark night, flash of lightning. What makes this flash of lightning occur? It's simply what is already inherent in all of us. It's there from the beginning. And that is what's called the Buddha nature. Tathagata Garbha. It's called, and Garbha is a seed, a womb, that which can germinate, which is already there. See? Tathagata is the one who has crossed over, understood that, understood reality. Such a glimpse. And it could just be a glimpse. It doesn't have to be what we think. You know, like if we have the image of a flash of lightning in a dark sky, we think that suddenly if we're sitting there, something's going to happen and we'll jump up and say, oh, that's it. The analogy of lightning in a dark sky is just to point out the contrast between ignorance and awakening. What a difference there is. When you're in a dark room and searching for the light switch, a room you've never been in before, your hand is going around on the wall trying to find out where it is. And at some point you can't find it and a little panic comes in. Could be the bathroom and you have to go to the bathroom. But you can't find the switch. And suddenly, flick, light. And everything is ordinary. There's a toilet, sink, everything's ordinary. You. In the same way, through application, practice, that comes about. But something else happens as well. That when we have that sense of awakening, we also begin to see how long it's been that we have created such turmoil for ourselves. We begin to feel somewhat wretched in thinking that I've been doing this for so long, creating pain upon pain for myself when it was simply a matter of flicking that switch, recognizing that light is important in a dark room so you can see what you're doing. How long? We begin to think, how long have I been doing this? This life? How many lifetimes? How long has it been that this pain has been regenerated because of my ignorance of a simple light switch? How long? We have been. When we have that experience, we begin to think of not only ourselves, but how long has everybody else been doing this? All beings that we know, our friends, our family, our mother, father, everybody we've met has been doing this. Self-inflicted pain. This awareness comes about to the practitioner, and we begin to think, this body, this time, this birth, is such a rarity, such a chance to actually not go back anymore, not to go back to samsara and self-induced pain. We begin to feel that way. We begin to feel that way in our body, mind. We begin to see that this precious opportunity doesn't even come to many human beings, let alone if you studied, you understand that look at the animals. Constantly searching for food. Constantly wondering who's chasing them. They eat something and something eats them. Constantly. That's the cycle of existence for an animal. Spirits, hungry ghosts, pretas. Their existence is constantly wanting to be fulfilled, but since they have no body, they cannot be fulfilled. So they hover around people like us, trying to get something. But there's no fulfillment. People in the realms of hell, total paranoia and fear. So much so that every gesture is another threat, another experience of pain. People in the realm of gods, feeling such bliss that there's ultimate fear that the bliss will someday disappear. Asuras, jealous gods, feeling that they've been tricked always, always wondering who's going to strike the next blow. In the human realm, our realm, how many people have the opportunity, the condition to be as we are now? Sitting here in the summer in Boulder, listening to Buddhist teaching. Very few. If you study in Gampopa, talks about the precious human birth, precious in 18 ways, free and well-favored, free from certain conditions and well-favored by other conditions. Are they going to study that? Is that? No, that's not part of it. Well, you should. It's not part of this particular course, maybe. Well, it is. It is now. You should study that. Why so? Because when you actually begin to have real experience of egolessness, oneself and other, then you start to develop a sense of preciousness of this particular birth, which is so evanescent, it's so impermanent, that we could be alive right now, and in 5 minutes we could be dead. There's no telling how long we're going to live, and what is accomplished by our life. What have we done? I'm not talking from the point of view of someone who would like to be chairman of ATT someday. I'm not talking about that. You know that. It's just very basic. What are we doing? What have we done? That comes up in the mind of the practitioner very strongly after having experienced some sense of egolessness. So, difficulty in achieving this particular well-favored situation. At the same time, we realize that it's possible to be decent, to do something decent in our lives. And that is the notion of Tathagata Garbha, Buddha nature, arising in us, that even on a non-verbal level, non-conceptual level, we begin to think it's possible to be decent, good, and wholesome human beings. It's like stirring. Like a spark. The wind blows and there's maybe a little bit of kindling, but a small fire begins to grow. And we think it's actually possible. We don't even think it, but we feel it. It's actually possible to be a decent human being. To do something decent with our lives. Tathagata Garbha is not a concept. So the Vajracharya talked about three things last time. Which one is it? Giving in, overcoming neurosis, and helping others. Those three things. So the first one is giving in. Giving in to what? What should we give in to? We actually give in to that feeling of decency, which is so gentle and so open. It undercuts all the aggression and brutality that arises from holding on to ourselves, who we are, ego. We give in to that, to feeling absolutely vulnerable and open. When we give into that, then we can actually see what the path is. That is, how to overcome. It doesn't take much more than a glimpse to really know this. It's not from the point of view of some sort of a memorization or drilling. Just a glimpse of one's own heart. And one's own gentleness produces a spark which ignites the fire, the kindling of awakened mind. That's called bodhicitta. Bodhicitta. Bodhi, we could say, is awake. Comes from a bud, Sanskrit, to awaken, to awake. Chitta, we could say, is mind. We also could say heart. It's been translated both ways. Awakening heart, awakening mind. Something is stirring. Something has stirred up in our being. A sense of awakening. Therefore, we realize that jealousy and hatred, pride, aggression, all of that can be overcome if we give in to our own gentleness and our own sense of being completely open, awake. There's one further thing, since we're studying Mahayana, which is very important, and that is that the sense of awakening, which begins with ourselves, friendliness to ourselves in Maitri, becomes karuna, compassion for others, ninje, when we realize that simply awakening for ourselves does not work, because ourselves and others are totally interdependent in egolessness. That is to say that one's own liberation still has a tinge of ego. As long as somebody else is suffering, then we also are suffering, because that somebody else in reality does not exist, but maybe somebody else doesn't know that. So therefore, if we have awareness of that, we basically have no choice to suffer as well. And therefore we have no choice but to dedicate our lives to people who have not realized that. If you have any questions, we could have a discussion.
When you were talking earlier, and you said that there is no reality, sort of no ultimate reality of mind, and
did I say that?
Yeah.
I don't think I said that.
You didn't say that? That's what I thought you said.
Anybody have those words? There's no ultimate reality of mind? Is that what you took down? It doesn't sound
Yeah, you said, actually, me actually is empty. Oh, me, not mind.
Me,
right.
Okay. Not mind, yeah. Me,
it has
yeah.
no definite reality of itself.
That's right, yeah.
Right.
Okay. All right, okay.
Get this straight.
We should get it straight, yes.
Excuse me?
We should get it straight.
Yeah.
Yes.
Okay, and when I apply this same logic, well, I think I'm applying this same logic to what you're saying, it creates a problem for me in terms of on what grounds I believe what you're saying this, and how does that relate to actions?
Mm-hmm. Well, basically, the whole notion of me saying this at this point is in itself without ego. Not so much that this is without ego or that is without ego, but the whole notion of saying it all together is called dharma. Dharma. And dharma is like a sieve. Put something in, it falls down. Doesn't stay. You can't hold it. So in a practitioner's mind or student's mind, hearing the dharma and trying to hold it is impossible because it sieves, because it doesn't have any ego. See? The actual Dharma itself doesn't have any sense of belonging to you or me. In terms of action, action is possible when there's conviction. Conviction is possible when there's practice. So, in terms of our study together, try not to pounce on what you hear, but still have a questioning mind, and apply that to actual sitting practice. That is to say, take whatever inquisitiveness there is and apply it to actual practice. And then whatever occurs from that, you can judge it for yourself.
Yeah. Thanks.
At the very beginning of your talk, you said that the basis for compassion would be one-pointed concentration. And this is somewhat unusual.
Foundation, yeah.
Just these words seem somewhat unusual here.
One-pointed?
Concentration.
Concentration, I suppose, if you're looking at it from a theistic point of view, would be concentration on something, you see? In this case, when we're talking about concentration, it's more the sense of actually allowing your mind to settle in its own place. That's a very concentrated thing to do.
Thank you.
It doesn't settle on anything, but it's like, you buy a concentrate of lemon juice and add water and you get a glass of lemonade or something like that. But what we're talking about here is the distilled thing, the concentrated version of all of what we think all the time, how we feel, how we act. What's the concentrated thing of that? You know, essence of that is a notion of practicing shamatha.
Could you say something more about Shunya and Tathagatagarbha? And
yes.
You said something about Tathagatagarbha is not a concept?
That's right, that's why it's Shunya. Shunya means without concept. You see? Shunya, empty. Empty of what? Empty of concept. Empty of a notion. Of existence. See, existence is a notion always. In our minds, we have this notion of being here somehow. And that's what's called duality, split. Rather than being here, we have this being here and notion of being here. Well, when we have this sense of experience, then being here doesn't have a notion to it. And then we suddenly realize, ah, simple. Tathagata. But that's a garbha at that stage. First sense of seed, you know, like pregnancy. Being impregnated. Shunya. We could say actually shunya is empty of past, present, and future. Three times altogether. Just is.
Could you explain what you mean by spirits hovering around without bodies?
Yeah, ghosts, you know. Ghosts, yeah. I'm sure that's not an uncommon word, ghosts. Aside from the movies, you know what I mean. There actually are beings that way, you know. Because the death was so abrupt and so painful, they have not actually let go. So the consciousness or memory still lingers as a being. And whatever it lingers because it has memory towards something, family, friends, a house, whatever, you know. Like in the movies, but not like in the movies. Yeah, it happens. Yeah. You know, everybody has experience of that. Sure, you know, you're in a place and you have this feeling that, well, there's somebody there, you know. It's called hungry ghost. Hungry because because of their action in their life. Same thing with us. Because of our action in our life, what we dedicated ourselves to, which might be jealousy and pride, hatred, lust, stupidity, if we dedicate ourselves to a particular thing, then actually we're prone to die that way. It's terrible, awful thing to think of, that such a thing happens all the time, you know. In our life, the same thing happens, moment to moment. With all these realms that I talked about, if you take it from just the psychological level, think how that happens day to day with us. If we have thoughts of jealousy, pride, or hatred, or something, we take on the form of that. We act that way. And we benefit, and the results come. If we have hatred, the result is we have sickness in the, you know, yuck. And pride, you know, and jealousy, we're always, you know, hungry, and, you know, nothing satisfies, and all that stuff, pride, and happens all the time. So at the moment of death, when one dies, this particular body dies, whatever is prevalent, that's the way it goes. Take that form. Hungry ghost, or jealous god, or god realm, animal realm. If there's stupidity at the moment of death, you take that animal realm because of your karma, what you've done, what we've done. There's jealousy. Then you become a asura, that kind of thing.
Are you invalidating certain passions or emotions?
Which ones?
Hatred, jealousy.
Invalidating them? What do you mean, invalidating? Am I saying they're not good? Yes, I'm saying they're not good. They're awful.
Is it not more important to be as aware of those feelings as one is aware of love or respect?
Well, that's what we talked about as foundation, you see. How things arise in one's being and one's mind. Hatred, jealousy. If you can actually look at those things without attaching this notion of me to them, then you can see how they arise, what they feel like, and how they subside. When you see that, you basically see that they have no substance.
But do not certain passions put man into action?
No. You mean man as a male or humankind? I have to be careful.
Mankind.
Mankind, yeah. No, well, what puts us into action is just if we look at it, there's two kinds of action. There's action which is based on those kleshas that we talked about, hatred, jealousy, passion, all that, and there's action which is based on intention to actually help or to manifest the sanity and enlightenment of all of us. So, two types of actions. And Shanti Deva says in the Bodhicharya Avatara that the virtue is very weak, but evil is very strong. Now, that's not Christian particularly. It's just a sense of samsara, or the klesha activity which goes on in our life constantly is so strong because of habitual tendency to do so. So strong that we begin to think that's what motivates me. That's the whole notion in the Western world altogether. Or every world, Western, Eastern, doesn't matter. The notion is that unless I have this notion of myself and I can conquer, I can win, I can love, hate, and all the rest of it and still be myself, then I'm going to be just like any other schmuck, peasant. This get kicked around. So I have to build up who I am. There's a difference there, you see. The point of view of bodhicitta, in awakening one's heart, you realize that you don't have to do it that way, ever. It's not necessary.
How do you relate to the concept of fear in what you were just talking about? Like, is some of the action that you take is really a fear of these things?
Everything is, every action is based on fear. When you have jealousy and pride and hatred and all those things, they're all based on fear. Fear of what? Uncertainty of the reality of who you are and what the world is. That's what generates fear. Uncertainty, ignorance, not knowing.
And also fear of these things that come up.
Well, that's secondary fear. The primary fear is just based on ignorance. And then because of that, we have to protect, you know, fend off or defend, and all these things that happen are secondary fear. Then there's more than that. You know, then there's fear which becomes monumental and turns into Hitler. Aggression. Becomes fear with the uniform, enthroned, everything, fear personified. It's all based on basic fear of not knowing what is this? Suddenly I'm in the midst of this world. It's interesting to think if you could remember when you were born, how you actually felt coming out. And where this fear started. You see what I mean?
Well, if all beings are empty, who is there to help or what is there to accomplish?
If you realize that, then you're the one to help. If you don't, then you need help. It's not just a concept, you know. We're not talking about blah, blah, blah. We're talking about actual experience. Emptiness is not just a nine-letter word. Reality. When you actually experience it, then you'll know who there is to help and how you should help. Up to that point, it's just wishful thinking. In the back there. Oh, by the way, don't try to experience emptiness. Doesn't work. Just sit with yourself and see who you are, how you work, you know, that kind of thing.
I'm trying to sort of work some stuff out, so it might take a little while. You said that shunya is without concept, that it's not a notion of something, but, and this is my jump, an actual experience of what it really is.
Is, it isn't.
Okay, experience of what it really isn't.
No, it is.
Well, okay. what is happening to me a lot is that, okay, you talked about kleshas and that when we practice, we can begin to have some relationship with seeing our habitual patterns and how we, how they come up and they arise and all that.
What they feel like.
What they feel like, what they taste like.
And when they're over, what you feel like.
When they're over, what we feel like.
Right.
Yeah, all that.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's an actual experience of some kind of actual gentleness
mm-hmm.
and some kind of tenderness and rawness.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And we look around ourselves and we see that we're generating, have been, and people are generating a lot of pain. And yet, my experience is that that realization itself is a somewhat painful one. In other words, so far
yes,
my experience...
Yes, okay. Yes, definitely.
Okay.
You feel wretched.
Yeah.
I've been doing this for so long.
Well, no, not exactly that one, actually.
Which one?
Doesn't have that dramatic quality to it. There's just sort of a, it's like background noise in a stereo. It's sort of just a low-level ache.
Yes, you have to practice more. Yeah. Practice more. It has to come right up front.
Well, no, wait a minute. What I'm saying... Wait, now, sir, come on.
I'm not going anywhere.
Okay, what I'm saying is... what I'm saying is that other one has come up.
Yes, that, it is. It's like background music. Yeah, I understand.
No, but the one that really hits and hurts, that's also come up.
Yeah.
It's just that is sort of like a peak in the oscillation, that blasting one.
Yes.
The sharp one.
Yes.
But there's going on a lot of the time when I slow down enough to check into it, a lower level one.
Yeah.
Or
I understand. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
So, one, I'm wondering, you know, suffering is one of the marks of existence. Is that's suffering or... You see what I'm saying? I'm confused about that pain. Is that still... Okay.
My anapath, we're talking about, that pain is just like your emotions, right? Every time you have emotional feelings, you feel the pain of that. Every time. You can't escape at all. That's based on your one-pointedness of your meditation practice. That when you practice one-pointedly, that's going to come up. Very strong. Especially when you feel healthy. More so. When you feel good, healthy, sane, then any little flicker becomes like a needle. And then you begin to develop some sense of compassion. You realize what it's like, the contrast, like lightning in a dark sky. The contrast of having felt sane, good, and then something happens.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you.